Hey everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU LPFM Lexington Community Radio. My name is Chuck.
I'm Ben.
And thanks for joining us here on this slightly overcast Friday. I hope everybody's had a good week.
Well, it's hot.
Yeah.
It's hot out.
Yeah. Well, when it rains, when you get precipitation, you get those high temps.
We were hypothesizing out in the lobby area that maybe it was all the hot wind blowing westerly.
Oh, from the course. That's funny. It is inauguration day today. So all those folks who are out and on a bus right now listening on your phone on the way to D.C. for the Women's March, you know.
I know some Trump supporters who are there today, and God love them. We just disagree, but we're staying friends.
Yeah, so, we're still America. You know. We're still trucking. We might feel a little stir crazy, but you know, we got to get along.
Well, the difference is, I think it's politics and the political parties and the campaigns and the ads and stuff like that. But it's real easy to get along with people with whom you disagree. I've said more than a few times, if I stop being friends with somebody because I thought they made a bad decision or a poor life choice, I would have no friends. I'd never talk to my family, and I'd have to kill myself.
Yeah. Just well, please don't do that, Ben. We like having you on the show. Speaking of which, of loving our neighbors despite our differences, or just loving our neighbors, really, here sure. In the studio, we have Lexington Vice Mayor Steve Kay joining us. Hey, Steve.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Doing good. How about yourself?
Just fine.
Excellent. So, Steve, thank you for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Happy to do it.
You know, here on Inauguration Day, a time where America is in a pretty interesting spot, yes, to say the least. Steve, can you tell us a little bit kind of about your background? Where you come from? Where were you born?
Well, I was born in Lawrence, Massachusetts, small old mill town north of Boston. I've been here 44 years, the greatest majority of my life has been spent in Lexington.
So Kentucky's home now, no doubt.
Kentucky's been home for a long time. I came and I really loved it.
What brought you here initially?
There's no short answer to that question. It's not any of the usual things.
It's usually the university. I know that's what brought my parents
here.
Well,
indirectly it did. I hit a point in my life when I had left a job. I had traveled for a year. I'd done some writing, and I wanted to get out of the New England winter. I wanted to get off the East Coast. This is 1971. It was a very crazy time politically. If you, I know you're not old enough to remember, but you know the history.
We've seen the movies.
Yeah, exactly. So. And I'd been through Kentucky on business a couple of years in a row, and I really liked it. And then a friend I'd been in graduate school with got a job at UK. So I came not knowing if I'd stay. I didn't have a job. I wasn't going to school. I didn't come because I was a spouse or an important other who had moved down here. But it's worked out very well for me.
Yeah, and now you're the vice mayor. Who'd have thought?
Who would have thought? I mean, you know. And I think that's actually a reflection on the way in which Kentucky in general, but Lexington in particular, is very welcoming to people who come in. And if you want to get involved and you want to do some things, you can do them. People, you know, welcome you on board. And if you stay at it, you can keep doing more and more.
That's true. It's a very tangible place, our state and our city, in fact, is.
Yeah.
So, Steve, were you involved in politics in Lawrence?
No.
How did you get initially involved in politics?
And well, I say no. I mean, I've been interested in politics, but I was not really active politically. Well, so yes and no. So I was involved in the 60s in some civil rights-related activities. I spent a semester at Morehouse College in Atlanta, which is a predominantly black college, part of the Atlanta University complex, 1964. Also a very interesting time to be in Atlanta, Georgia.
In the South,
So I had a generalized interest. And then in the early 80s, a friend ran for a city council position, and I did some work on that campaign. And then worked on some other campaigns and with Ernesto Scorsone and other folks. And got interested in running myself a dozen years ago and decided to give it a shot.
That's awesome. So what did you study in school, Steve?
I was a philosophy major.
Philosophy? Hey, that's important. You know, as we talked
we
about
this last week. We mentioned that last week, yeah.
About Marco Rubio's comment of...
The philosophy of welding.
Yeah, he said we need more welders, less philosophers, and how absurd that notion is, that one is more important than the other, that our nation is based on French philosophy, you know.
Well, it is an interesting kind of a comment, because it takes a relatively easy slam at what looks like a very esoteric kind of thing to be doing. As it turns out, I mean, not that I need to defend philosophy. I haven't been involved really in anything academic in the last 35 years. But something like philosophy, the study of philosophy, is really about critical thinking. And whether you're a welder or an academic, critical thinking is a great thing to have, and to contrast those two and to say, you know, do we need more welders? Yes. Do we need more respect for people who do that kind of work, who work with their hands, who do the essential work? Yes.
Absolutely.
They need, but not at the expense, please, of folks who make a living a different way.
Mm, absolutely. And so do you make any art yourself, Steve?
I, at this point, very little. Mm-hmm. I actually had a slight identity when I first came to Kentucky. I was doing silkscreen printing. Mm. I was a member of the Kentucky Guild, went to their fairs, Lexington Art League, and did a fair amount of printmaking in the 70s. Mm. And then lifestyle changes, business work, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and it kind of fell away. And I've mostly, in the last however many decades, mostly done stuff on my computer.
Cool.
Just computer drawings.
Yeah. New canvas.
Yeah. Well, easy. Yeah, that's the other thing. Yeah. No materials needed, and, you know, no expense, and you can fool around and modify, and yeah.
Are you using the tablet and the pen, or how are you going about doing that?
Just using paint. So I use the mouse as a...
I was thinking of what interface.
So when I was doing silkscreen printing, I was also keeping a journal and doing some pen and ink drawings and colored pencil. Mm-hmm. So if you think about pen and ink and then coloring in...
Oh, absolutely.
Paint is, except for the fact, of course, that the definitions are, you know, it looks like a computer drawing, but but very, very malleable. And obviously you can do, you know, you want to do 100, go right ahead.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that's cool.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So, Steve, so you're the vice mayor and an at-large council member. So how does someone become the vice mayor? Or how do you become an at-large? For folks that don't know, for folks that aren't aware of how our city government works and who might be listening, how does one go about doing that?
Well, for me, the route came in part... As I said, I'd been involved in a lot of political races, so I knew a fair number of people in town who were involved in politics. And I live in the 1st District, which is a district that has enjoyed minority representation ever since I've lived in Lexington. Mm. And as a white guy, I didn't feel comfortable running for that district. That would have been the place to start. Mm-hmm. And I think getting involved in neighborhood association, thinking about a district race, if you're interested in that, and then possibly moving up from there. So that really wasn't an option for me. But this is now however many years ago, 2006. It seemed to me that I might have a shot at an at-large seat. There were not a lot of incumbents running, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the long story, kind of compress it all, is that I ran, the first time I ran for an at-large seat, it was my first run for political office, and the way that the at-large race works is a pool of candidates. It's a nonpartisan race, so anybody can run. The parties don't choose candidates. Typically, somewhere between 9 and 12 people sign up. The primary reduces that number to 6, and then in the general, 3 of those 6 get elected to at-large seats, and the top vote-getter becomes the vice mayor. Mm. So the first time I ran, I just missed the cut for the primary. I was, like 170 votes. It was very disappointing.
Yeah.
Second time, am I going to run again? I don't know. I decided, I'll give it another shot. Again, I looked at it and thought, maybe. Second time I ran, I missed getting elected by about 1,000 votes.
Oh my God.
Oh no.
That's so close.
So
wrong way.
Wow. Yeah. Well, in the general, the gaps are a little bit longer. Anyway, third time I ran, I won a seat. I was I got the least votes of the three, but I got elected.
That's great.
And then in the next election, I was the top vote getter.
Oh, congratulations.
So one of the ways you do it is you run. And every time you run, you learn something about what it means to run. And if you're doing a good job of running the races and the people like what you're doing and they will continue to support you, you build on that base.
What were some of the lessons that you learned in between, let's say, elections 2 and 3 or 3 and 4 that you wish you knew on day one?
Well, they were mostly about how to organize a campaign and how to involve people in a meaningful way. There wasn't a great deal of difference between the first time I ran and the last time I ran, except for the fact that I knew more people, I had more people working on the campaign, I knew better how to organize it, I knew how to allocate resources and so on. And I would say one other thing. I understood a lot better about how to use the money that I raised strategically in terms of media and mass mailings and signs and, you know, all of that kind of thing.
Well, that's great. Well, we're glad you stuck with it, Steve.
Thank you. Me too.
Yeah. So can I ask you, if folks out there have something they want to say, and I think city government plays an important role in being accessible to the people, without a doubt. And so if people want to ask you about something or a topic that they want to discuss, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, the easiest way, and I think it's really very effective, is that there's a central number for city government. Mm-hmm. It's 311.
Yeah, had to call it the other day. Yeah.
Okay.
They were great.
And I used it myself.
Maybe the nicest woman I've ever talked to in my life.
Oh, yeah. They do a good job. When you call 311, they're very pleasant and they're very helpful. And so whatever you want from city government, if you call 311 and say, I have a problem with my trash pickup.
That's where I go.
Okay, I saw a sign in the road that shouldn't be there. I've got a neighbor who's causing whatever.
Yeah.
So you can ask general questions, or you can say, I'd like to talk to councilman so-and-so, your own district council person, one of the at-large people, the vice mayor, the mayor, whatever.
If you don't know your council person, can they look that up for you?
Yes, they can.
Excellent.
So, if you tell them where you live, they can then figure out what district you're in. Because people, a lot of people anyway, aren't paying close enough attention. And if you ask them what district, they won't know, or even who their representative is, but they can find out very easily.
True. So 311, that's the spot. There's an app too. I've checked out the app before. That's also very helpful. So you don't even have to call anyone. You can just look on that to find out who your representatives are.
And I know it's that time of year, or it should be that time of year, when you see winter storms and maybe stuff in the street that really shouldn't be in the street. Is that a 311 call also?
Yes. Yeah.
Branches and trash cans and stuff.
Anything where you think the government has some responsibility for taking some kind of action to help. And you can find out if we do or don't do that by calling 311.
And power lines and things of that. Anything dangerous, I think.
Yeah, and if it's not a city function, you'll get referred by them. So people sometimes call in about Lextran. Well, Lextran has its own board. It's a quasi-governmental agency, and the mayor appoints. We approve those members. But they hire a management company, and Lextran is run quasi-independently. So if you've got a Lextran issue, the call 311 and they'll connect you. Or if it's a school issue, a lot of people don't understand that the school system and city government are completely separate.
Maybe if you're looking for is school in session today with the snow on the ground, 311 is not that.
Yeah, you'd be better off calling LEX 18.
Yeah,
or Fayette County.
But what I would say about 311 is they're very good about if it's not a government function, they pretty much know whose responsibility it is, and they'll give you an idea about who to call.
Yeah, well, that's great. Well, just in case you're joining us, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU. We're here with Lexington Vice Mayor Steve Kay, chatting about all kinds of things, Lexington in general and beyond. So which leads me to my next question, Steve. I'm curious, kind of, what relationships are there between Lexington and Louisville's city councils? Do they talk? Do they kind of discuss? Because the reason I ask is because the recent minimum wage increase and, mm-hmm. and how that got passed and how Louisville and Lexington kind of exist in this spot in Kentucky of being kind of the, you know, the progressive predecessors of ways that the rest of our state will be governed and how we act, you know, how other legislation statewide gets initiated. So is there a relationship between Lexington and Louisville city councils?
There really is not.
Hmm. How about a connection between Lexington and the state government? Is that...
Well, there's connection in that respect. There are definitely connections because we have our own elected officials and they're... We know who they are. We talk yeah. with them about issues, and we have the city. If it, the city has issues, the city has a lobbyist, goes to the legislature, and works with our delegation in particular. But let me get back to the Louisville question. I think it would be interesting if we did more. But I think both councils are pretty kind of busy with kind of their own initiatives. There's more of a relationship at the administrative level. So the mayors talk more, and there's this joint economic development activity that goes on that's about advanced manufacturing. And there's a few other things. And I'll say one more thing about that whole topic. More generally, we don't do as well as we could or should do in terms of regionalism and in terms of relating to the rest of the state. I think there's an opportunity there, a lot of opportunities. And there's good reason why we're all in our own little arenas and we're busy with what we're doing, but I think there's an opportunity to reach out more.
Yeah, like Wendell Berry said, think global, act local.
Right.
So I like that a lot.
Yeah.
And you know, Kentucky's kind of in this unique spot anyway in the United States where we're too far north to be south, too far south to be north. And especially Lexington being right in the middle of it as being even more of a microcosm of a microcosm. Do you think that Lexington plays a special role in kind of being the conscious voice of the rest of the state or really kind of being the cheerleaders as far as how our state should develop?
Well, so of course I have my own bias about
sure,
what that means and how, you know, what's important. There are some of my colleagues on council would probably see this differently, but so Lexington really is its own place. Mm-hmm. I came here 40 some odd years ago. I really liked it when I arrived. I continue to like it more and more and more. Lexington is one of the few places in the country that really has its own definition of itself and is comfortable with that definition.
That's a great point.
It starts with the horse capital, being the horse capital of the world. It includes the green space that we have preserved so effectively. And people identify with that. So Lexington has been, for a long time, blessed in a few ways. One, moderately prosperous and an economic base that's fairly diverse, more diversified since the IBM started, located a plant here in the 50s. Mm-hmm. But with the university, with the horse farms, et cetera, there's a nice base under our economy that cushions us from the worst aspects of the recent downturn of 2008. There's a feeling about the commitment to Lexington, which I think has been growing. And you guys are in what I would consider the younger generation. But for the 20-somethings and 30-somethings, if you'd asked people, certainly 15 years ago, probably 10 years ago, maybe even 5 years ago, you know, is Lexington really a happening place? Is there enough to do? Is it exciting? You would have got a mixed reaction at best. I think now...
Oh, it's blowing up.
It's hot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
It's really, you know, there's so much going on. And it builds on what we have had all along, which is a fairly small but vital downtown and this amazing green space that is a part of our heritage.
It's true.
What industry or aspects of social life have you seen grown in the last 10 years that kind of makes it a little bit of a more happening town?
Well, I think the obvious answer to that is the brew pubs. Mm-hmm. Okay, so 10 years ago, zero. I believe, unless I may have my history wrong, but I believe that West 6th is now 6, 7 years
2011,
old.
2011, 2012, I think.
Yeah, it's not. It's young.
It's pretty young, yeah.
And they may, and now we have a dozen.
Mm-hmm, yeah, we've got a lot with Ethereal and Rock House.
Yeah, I know. It's to the point where that's the only beer I drink is what's made locally.
Without a doubt. And I remember traveling around out west and going to Colorado and California and seeing all these places and wondering, gosh, I wish Lexington had something like this.
So it's a feeling. My annual consumption of beer prior to all the brew pubs was about a 6-pack a year. I don't drink much, and I'm not a big, I have an occasional beer. Mm-hmm. But I know a lot of the people that are involved in those, and I also am a big fan of Smithtown Seafood. Mm-hmm. So I find myself at West 6th often. I like to go there and watch ball games too. Mm-hmm. But now my annual consumption of beer is up to probably 4 6-packs a year, but it's all local.
Yeah.
But if I drink a beer at all, it's going to be one of the local brews. So it's that and the way in which some of these businesses have been put together. And I know best the people who've been involved with the Bread Box in West 6. And my understanding of what they're about is, yes, they are in business. It's a for-profit organization. Mm-hmm. But they're also very committed to using what they have to benefit the community. So the Bread Box has got, at this point, it's got alternative office space. Mm. It's got a restaurant. It's got the Roller Girls still...
They do? Yeah.
They still practice there. So there's art studios. Yeah. So there's a lot going
Food
on.
Food chain.
Yeah. And so a year and a half ago, I had a couple of friends from my former life in New England, one who now lives in D.C. and one who now lives in Atlanta, visiting. So I took him to West 6th and Smithtown Seafood, and they were blown away. They said,
it's great.
We wish we had this in our city. So. Yeah.
I remember my dad the other day saying Jefferson Street is an overnight 30-year success in Lexington. There's a lot of effort, and I used to live nearby, and it was just walking distance, and I didn't have to worry about driving or parking, and it was great. So you've got Stella's over there, you've got West 6, you've got wine bars, you've got... what's the music place? Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Up there. It's great.
There's a lot going on. And I really think, the emphasis of Kentucky Proud Movement, the Lexington Farmers Market really distributing. And I think the university is paying an emphasis on, like having the South Farm in UK and growing our own vegetables and taking pride in kind of the wide variety of local foods. And really the harvest that we have is incredible.
So there's a lot of positive elements kind of coming together. Mm. So and Jefferson Street is a great example because it really starts with people who were interested in preserving some of the historic houses in that area.
Yeah.
So again, I happen to know one of the people who his joke is the more houses he buys, the less money he makes. But he bought early on. He lives in that neighborhood. He bought early on Jefferson because there were some buildings he thought needed to be maintained, restored. He never thought he would really get his money out.
Mm.
Well, 10 years later, first Stella's, which is actually one of the elements that comes together here, is it was started by people who were at UK, who were in the Gaines Fellows Program, who... as a part of that program, there's a big emphasis on a relationship to your community. So they were intrigued by Lexington. They decided to stay. They bought.
Shout out to Paul Holbrook.
Yeah, Paul Holbrook is a part of that. And then buying Al's bar So there's all these people who basically think this is already a good place. I can help to make it better, and I can make a living here.
Mm-hmm.
So historic preservation, entrepreneurship, civic responsibility. All kind of come together.
Yeah, in a delicious plate of food grown a few miles away.
Yeah. And the local food movement has been very important, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
The farmers, now so, historically give a shout out to former Mayor Pam Miller, who was instrumental in getting the farmers market started. And that's another example of something that started small and slowly but surely grew until the pavilion really kind of helped it blossom.
Yeah.
And it's not, so now it's important for the farmers, but it's also a cultural event every Saturday morning in season. People go down there to walk their dogs and their kids and see folks as well as get fresh produce.
Yeah, I think it's a renaissance of a celebration of Kentucky's makers in so many ways, which I love. And, you know, our city's growing every year, right? It's a pretty tremendous, tremendous growth.
Yes, it is.
And so, Steve, you're also the head of the Infill and Development Committee, is that right?
Infill and Redevelopment,
Redevelopment. So can you tell us a little bit about that and kind of, I know the council is kind of having a discussion about the Affordable Housing Fund. Can you talk to that a little bit?
Sure. So one of the things that I've become fond of saying when we talk about the city is that Lexington right now is really in a sweet spot. We have had, I think, consistently good leadership within government for the past 40, since merger, maybe before, but we're since merger. Our economy has been fairly steady. We haven't suffered, you know, big losses and so on. We've grown and we've maintained the boundary that we set up so long ago. So we have this unusual situation where we've got a county, a merged county government, which was also a big decision that this community made that was very important. And we benefit from that every day, from having a merged government. So you look at the merged county government, we've got 310,000 people living here, give or take. Two-thirds of our land mass is still in farmland. Despite the fact that we have this fairly urbanized area.
Two-thirds. Wow.
Yeah. We've been growing in the past 5 years, the growth in Lexington has slowly crept up. We had been at about 3,000 people a year for decades, just pretty steady growth. Now we're up, we've escalated a little bit. And the challenge, I think, is to maintain the livability, the walkability, the small town feel.
The affordability.
As we continue to grow. And what is most challenging about that is that at this point we have, for the most part, used for development most of the land that's within the urban service boundary. So we really have a choice. When we think about continued development, we can grow out and use up some of that green space, which I'm not in favor of, or we can grow up, which means more density, using vacant properties, underutilized properties. But all of that puts a lot of pressure on people who are at the lowest end of the economic spectrum. The question of being able to afford rents, the question of being able to afford to buy a house. So what we've done is a couple of things. The mayor appointed a task force on homelessness, which I had the honor of chairing a few years ago, but that included looking at affordable housing issues. And out of that came a recommendation which the council accepted to create an Office of Affordable Housing with a dedicated funding stream of $2 million a year and an Office for Homelessness Prevention and Intervention with its own $750,000 funding stream. So we now have staff whose everyday job is to look at those issues, and we have funding to help them do that work. The Affordable Housing Trust Fund has spent or allocated $7 million over the last 2.5 years to provide essentially last gap financing. So if you're at all interested in affordable housing, what you know is you can't build at the current rates and make it affordable. Yeah. So you need some kind of assistance. So Affordable Housing Fund provides loans or forgivable loans as a part of a larger financing package that's allowed us to keep as affordable some developments, some multi-unit developments, which were built with government money and restricted by income, which were terming out of their limitations. So next year, I won't have to, you know, abide by those restrictions. I may want to make it market rate or whatever. So we have stabilized some of those by providing some support for rehab and so on, and kept those affordable. And then we've generated a fair number of additional projects.
That's awesome.
Well, Chuck, let's take a quick break. And Brian Carter of the Brian C. Project emailed me his last single, and I promised him I'd play it on the air. And it's pretty good, so I want to get to that.
That's great. Former guest of Bluegrass Bios.
Yeah, two-time guest.
That sounds great.
So this will be the world premiere of that.
Well, just in case you're joining us, thank you. And thanks for listening. We're here with Lexington Mayor Steve Kay, Lexington Vice Mayor Steve Kay, and we'll be right back here. You're listening to 93.9 WLXU FM.
Lexington. Oh, and this is Tell You Why.
I still miss you. I see you every day. I could touch you, feel you in every way. I can feel you beating through my heart. Pour me till I'm dry. Take a chance and life will fall apart. I guess I'm just going for the ride, yeah. I could never tell you.
Lexington Community Radio's programming is powered by West 6 Brewery, serving Kentucky-crafted microbrewed beer in a historic 100-plus-year-old former bakery called the Bread Box, located at 501 West 6th Street in Lexington. West 6 has over 15 different original beers on tap, including the West 6 IPA, West 6 Amber, Lemongrass Wheat, and Pay It Forward Cocoa Porter. West 6 canned beers can be purchased all over the Commonwealth and in the tap room. Flavors change daily and feature weekly firkin and barrel-aged short-run beers. For the kids, local kombucha and soda is always on tap, too. You can also visit West 6's new downtown tap room, the West 6 Green Room, located at 109 West Main Street. For more information, visit www.west6.com. Think local, drink local. Lexington Community Radio thanks West 6 for supporting true community radio.
This is Lydia Jacobs, host of Aging Adventures. We keep everyone up to date on what's going on in the senior community in Lexington, conferences available, how to stay healthy. We talk to a wide range of people, professionals, individuals who are paving their own way in the aging world. Aging Adventures with host Lydia Jacobs on Fridays, 2 o'clock to 3 o'clock on 93.9 WLXU, a Lexington community radio.
Hey everybody, you're listening to Bluegrass Bios here on 93.9 WLXU, Lexington Community Radio. I'm Chuck.
I'm Ben.
And we're here in the studio with Lexington Vice Mayor Steve Kay.
Hello.
Hey Steve, thanks for joining us today so much.
Happy to do it.
I know you're busy. A busy man, so we appreciate you coming down and chatting about what's going on. So when is the next council meeting? Do you know?
Not for a couple of weeks. So we meet roughly every 2 weeks, although the calendar, we meet twice a month. And it's roughly every 2 weeks for the formal council meetings, which are Thursday nights at 6. And we meet every week in work session and committee meetings on Tuesdays.
Nice. And if people want to come to the city council meetings just to observe or to have something be said, how do they go about doing that?
They can just walk in and come up to the, go through the, get badged, come up to the second floor. If they want to speak, they can sign in. And there's an opportunity at the beginning and the end of meetings for comments on the agenda and not on the agenda. And if they have a larger issue that they'd like to have discussed, they typically, the best thing to do is talk to your council rep or your at-large or the vice mayor and say, here's an issue I think needs to be addressed. And most of the substantive conversation about issues happens in committee meetings and work session. Mm. The council meetings are the formal requirement where every ordinance and resolution is read twice in different meetings. And so it's a lot of the clerk just reading those things mm-hmm. in the formal meetings. Sometimes there are other things going on, but if you're interested really in the way in which this council actually deliberates, Tuesdays, council meeting, the work sessions, or the committee meetings are the place to be.
That's great. And speaking of council members doing work, relatively recently, Lexington City Council approved for a minimum wage hike. I guess it was a 9-6 vote, nine in favor.
It was 9-6.
And so, yes. But recently, the Kentucky Supreme Court came back and said that. For whatever reason, that wasn't permissible,
yeah.
And so they've overrode it. So, is the council have any feelings about that, or do you personally have
what can we do about that?
Yeah, we can't do much about it. So, what's not always obvious when we get a court ruling is what is the basis. And a lot of people think, oh, the Supreme Court of Kentucky ruled that you can't increase the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. But that's not what they ruled. Mm-hmm. What they ruled was that this kind of legislation at the local level is not permissible given the state's responsibility for making certain kinds of laws and regulations. So what their ruling was is that the state has set a minimum wage. Mm-hmm. And this is one of those areas where the local governments don't have the option of modifying that. Now, people can agree or disagree with that and where the local control ought to be able to do that. But once the Supreme Court says, no, the state has the right to do that and you localities do not, that's the end of the conversation. Mm. It was very disappointing. We worked for about a year and a half on that issue. It was a very good, I thought, a very good example of this council deliberating carefully. People saw it differently. Those of us who supported it believe that the benefit to the roughly 25,000-30,000 people who now work at or below the 1010, which we would eventually get to, mm-hmm. that the benefit to them was so substantial that even if there was some modest dislocation. So part of the argument is, oh, if you raise the minimum wage, there's going to be fewer jobs, it's going to be harder to entry. The research basically says those negative effects are minimal, but there are some there. Mm. So, you know, you look at it and say, well, okay, but so many people are going to benefit.
Right.
And it's related to this question of affordable housing. So I'm working at a minimum wage job. If I get a dollar an hour raise,
it's a big deal.
Just think
that's
about
huge.
That. Yeah. That's a big change in my life. And the next year I get another buck, and the next year I get another buck. Mm-hmm. And now instead of making $7.25, I'm making $10.10. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot. I have, as a low-income earner, a lot more money in my pocket for the essentials, including paying the rent. So
and a rising tide lifts all boats in this instance, because when the minimum wage goes up, that's when I, just speaking personally, anecdotally, in my job history, that's when I've gotten a raise of significance, mm-hmm. is when the minimum yeah. wage has gone up.
Yeah, so there's, you know, but some people look at the economics of it and they say, oh, it, you know, it doesn't really work that way. I think the evidence is pretty clear, but and on balance, it's absolutely the right thing to do. I wish we were in a state that's as progressive as Lexington is, mm-hmm. and that the state would raise the minimum wage. I think what's going to happen is that over the next, you know, pick a number, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, we're going to get raises. Either mm-hmm. it'll happen at the national level and or at the state level, because it's happening in localities that are permitted under their constitutions.
Yeah.
There's, you know, more and more localities are raising, more and more states are raising the minimum mm-hmm. wage. Eventually, mm-hmm. other states will go along. So
yeah, and I think that's where I was so confused, and I guess it just comes down to the difference in state law. But whereas, you know, San Francisco and Seattle raise their minimum right. wages, then why aren't their state Supreme Courts right. coming back and saying, hey, you can't do that, you know?
Yeah, and so, why aren't all the fast food places closing in yeah. Seattle?
Yeah, so yeah, and all of the doomsday arguments about the negative effects on immediately mm-hmm. on small business, mm-hmm. have there's no reasonable research that supports that. But yeah, so you know, why in Kentucky, it's a combination of the way in which our state constitution is written, mm-hmm. and state legislation about those kinds of things, and the interpretation that the Supreme Court gives mm-hmm. it. So,
is there any worry about businesses that are outside of Lexington maybe having a difficult time competing with businesses that are located in Lexington that pay better? Like maybe people will commute back and forth. Was that an argument?
People already do that.
That was an argument. But it, again, research basically indicates that that in places where there are either localities or states that have passed minimum wage increases and their neighbors have not, mm-hmm. there just is not
the evidence just isn't there.
I missed what you said.
There's no evidence that'll cause businesses outside of Lexington to shut down.
There's very, very little, yeah.
And also, just off the top of my head, is inflation a concern locally with cost of living or rent or anything like that? Do the numbers indicate anything about that?
Well, a part of what produces for us a difficulty with affordable housing is that if you look at the graph of the cost of housing mm-hmm. in Lexington, it's going up at a nice, relatively steep angle at the moment. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the purchasing power of the minimum wage, it's going down. Mm-hmm. So it's that gap. You look at the at one point, you could work minimum wage and afford a reasonable house mm-hmm. Rent. Mm-hmm. That's not true anymore
right.
because the purchasing power has gone down and the relative cost of housing has gone up. And that'll be, I know we were going to get to this, but that's one of the issues that will be discussed when we get into discussion of the comprehensive plan.
Yeah, and can you tell people, Steve, what is the comprehensive plan?
So any government that has a planning zoning regulations at all, and some places in Kentucky do not have them.
Wow, that's,
there are a lot of rural counties. There's no zoning regulations.
It's a tire fire next to an elementary school,
basically.
Yeah.
But if you have them, then there's a bunch of regulations about what you need to do and how you need to do it. One of the rules is that every 5 years you must produce initially a comprehensive plan for all land use, and then an update of that plan. And that means looking at all of the different kinds of zones that we have and whether we have the right balance between zoning for industrial and residential mm. and commercial and so on and so on. And it also looks at some of the larger issues about what kind of community we want to have. So we are about to embark on a revision of our comprehensive plan, the five-year plan, which will be completed in 2018. But there'll be a lot of conversation about it between now and then, starting with a series of meetings that the planning department will have at the mostly libraries around town in February.
Yeah, and I know Bluegrass Community Foundation is organizing the On the Table events, which are kind of also giving public input into that overall comprehensive plan, you know.
Yes, they're organizing an opportunity for people to come together and look at a variety of issues, including people's thoughts about the comprehensive plan and what needs to be in it and does it need to be modified. But the big issue will be whether to expand the urban service boundary. Mm. So, as I said before, we have this unusual situation where we have a fairly fairly dense already center population, city and suburbs, and then we have all of this green space. So the question is, in my mind, is what do we want our county, our city county, to look like when we are all done expanding mm-hmm. into green space, because the land is a finite resource mm-hmm. and we can expand into 5,000 acres now and then again in 10 years and then again in 10 years. But eventually, if we do that,
yeah.
we either make a decision to stop or we have to stop because there's no land left.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it would be a mistake to go to the point certainly where we max out and we'd have no more rural area.
Well, I think the surrounding greenery is part of what makes Lexington kind of an attractive place to live,
and
that you can leave the city and go somewhere.
It's our
spacious.
Distinction, and yeah. and it makes and all of the polling that I've seen over the years when we're looking at issues that people care about and how they feel about it, suggests that somewhere between 65 and 75% of the people put preserving green space at the top of their list, and they understand the value that it has. So the argument on the other side is that we're growing and we have to have places for people to live and work. My answer to that is that will always be true so long as this is an attractive place to live. So the question is, when are we going to stop using green space for development? I think we're close to the end right now. I'm not, I mean, somebody could show me some places where we could actually do some development that would not negatively impact the farm community, that would not negatively impact the viewshed, that would, you know, maybe. But I think the default position is we need to do more infill and redevelopment. And what that means for this community is that we will be, and we just had a zone change hearing last night. It started at 7 o'clock and ended at 11:45.
Wow.
This was after a council meeting.
Well, what were you all discussing?
There's been a fair amount of publicity about this particular piece of property where an individual has developed an outdoor a zip line with outdoor recreation, and whether that's an appropriate use. And there's a long way too involved for us to get into, but a long history. But the Planning Commission had approved a zone change that would allow that kind of activity conditionally, and then they had approved the conditions, and it came to council, and
people had some problems with the conditions.
Well, there were people who've been opposed all along, and they continue to be opposed. Were some technical issues. I mean, it got into what I would consider the most difficult parts of all of zoning. Very technical and intricate, and there were procedural questions, et cetera, et cetera. I mean,
these are very passionate people.
Yeah, on both sides. So, I mentioned that only because what's happened in the last couple of years, as the economy has really rebounded, is that we're now doing a lot of development. So the Planning Commission is much busier than they were, and the council hears appeals, basically, on zoning issues. So we have to approve zoning issues, either approve them without a hearing or have a hearing, and we're doing more and more and more of that.
Yeah, and you can tell in areas like particularly here on the north side where we're broadcasting, you know, Manchester District, you know, there is a lot of establishment and businesses growing in places that typically were either post, you know, previously industrial or abandoned you know, used to be thriving and fell off for whatever reason. So,
well, speaking of development, we still have that whole downtown.
What hole would that be?
Oh, where is it? I don't know. It's kind of beautiful in its own way. I'm getting used to it in just a kind of artistic kind of way. Where do we stand on all that? What's the progress? There's been some progress recently.
Well, you know, I joke about that whole issue, and that is that as it gets developed, the level of conversation generally in Lexington is going to go down because people aren't going to know what to talk about.
That's
like,
true.
You know, we talk about the weather. If you have, you know, casual conversation.
Yeah, how about those cats?
Yeah, how about this? So it's been a topic for so long, and people have been so concerned about it. But what's happening now is that if you look down in the hole, you can, by the way, you can get a twofer. You can the 21C Museum, which is open to the public 24 hours a day. It's great. It's a great place to visit. Changing exhibits, a wonderful asset for downtown. But if you go in to 21C and go up to the second floor gallery, you can look right down into Center Point. Okay, so you can see for yourself, and they are basically building the forms for the garage.
Yeah, and the garage is owned by the city, though, right?
No.
But the city has some skin in it with the TIF financing, right? Is that true?
Well, so the way it works is that...
It's a grant of some kind, isn't it?
So, yeah, let me try. Let's see if I can do it without getting into, again, getting into the weeds. Tax increment financing is a way for the state and local government to reimburse developers for infrastructure that will have some public use, so like a parking garage. And what that means is that if the land at the moment has a tax value, a tax value, you know, of $1 million,
sure,
and it's improved with a garage and then with development on top of it, and now it's yielding $4 million. Mm. The difference between what it was yielding and what it's now yielding can be rebated to the developer to defray the cost of infrastructure. So right now, the city does not have a dime in that.
I see.
If and as they get the parking garage completed and they begin to develop on top of it and to develop some revenue, the tax on that revenue will go to reimburse the developer for their investment in infrastructure up to a certain amount over a certain amount of time.
I see.
So, yes, we have a dog in the fight, but...
Yeah. Well, thank you for explaining.
We want it to be successful, so that'll bring in some money to the city.
We want it to be successful because downtown needs to have that home.
and it's been there for a long time. And, you know, there is this role that city council has, but also it's limited. And, you know, that's a private space. You know, the Webs own that land, so they can build whatever they want on it, right?
They can build on it, and... for better or worse, they cannot build on it.
Yeah.
So we have, there are other pieces of property in town that have been vacant. They're not as central to downtown. They're not as visible. They haven't been as much of an issue. But there are other places where developers are hoping to develop. They've cleared off land, and the land is sitting there. The city cannot make you develop a piece of property.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's where I think people
you
get confused.
Can't do that.
Yeah.
And there's good reason why we can't do that.
Absolutely.
You know? Yeah. So there are...
Once you've started, you should keep going and finish your
project. Once you start, then we have the city can inspect to see that you're moving forward and that you're abiding by, you know, agreements and so on and so on. Yep.
Well, that's great. Well, Steve, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us. And you know,
I wish we had more time.
I do too.
Yeah.
I mean, we could go on and on. And I promise this won't become a zoning meeting after a council meeting. I'm glad we were able to chat with you and learn more about you and more about your invaluable work with the city council.
Well, I appreciate being invited. I really appreciate what the radio station is doing for the community.
Well, thank you. Well, thank you. You know, we do what we can, you know. Well, nonetheless, we'll be back next week. The re-air of this is going to air Saturday at 11 a.m.
Yeah, that'll be Saturday at 11, and then we're also on iTunes.
Mm-hmm.
If you go to the podcast section of the iTunes store and search for Bluegrass Bios, we pop right up, and then you can listen on LexingtonCommunityRadio.org, podcasts, Bluegrass Bios, posts, all of our past shows available to listen anytime you want, Chuck.
That's
anytime.
Great. And we will. So nonetheless, Aging Adventures is up next. Thank you for listening to Bluegrass Bios. Thanks again to Steve Kay, Dr. Wormling, Kyle Bigelow, and the Bengineer. And I'm Chuck, and I will see you next week. Adios.